Now, just some advice if you have young children in your company. Some of the subject matter we're about to discuss may be confronting. Now, as the Royal Commission continues its journey around the country, hearing stories of sexual abuse of children over decades, we've had two things reinforced: that no religious organisation is free from this scourge, and that for so many of those who experienced abuse, speaking out was made all the more difficult because of the positions of respect that abusers often held. And for many WACs, that's certainly the case. Growing up within Australia's ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, he had to break an ancient tradition forbidding Jews from going outside that community to get justice. As a consequence, he and his family no longer live in Australia. They now live in France, where he says, "No one whispers when we walk down the street." Manny Wax is here at the moment, though, because he's written a book about his experience. It's called Who Gave You Permission? The Memoir of a Child Sexual Abuse Survivor Who Fought Back. Manny, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you for having me, Cassie.
Can I ask you firstly to describe your life growing up in the Chabad universe, as you call it? Because for many listeners, this is very unknown. What was daily life like?
Yeah, look, I was going to say maybe it's a movement, but it really is not. It's so much more than that. It's not only a lifestyle. It's your life. It's your world. Every aspect of your day is dictated by the movement, by the religion, or by the religious aspect, the way Chabad interprets religion. And there are many wonderful things about it, you know, focusing on family and Jewish festivals and the Sabbath, and you have meals together and there's a lot of song. Mm. It's a very warm and beautiful environment. Mm. And I have some very fond memories of that environment. But every single aspect. You wake up in the morning, you've got to wash your hands, you've got to say prayer before you put any food in your mouth.
You can't take three steps without washing when you get out of bed.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I think I refer in the book to one case, one issue that it took me years to get rid of, which was wiping the eyes with your hands before you wash your hands, because until you do that, the myth was back then that you might go blind if you don't wash your hands first and you touch it because your hands are impure. Mm. And by touching your eyes. So, you know, there are those kinds of extreme teachings and stories that are related to us. But as I said, it's both positive and negative, because there is really that sense of community. One important distinction between Chabad and some of the other Hasidic and in particular non-Hasidic movements is that there's that central figure of the Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Rebbe means, it's another way of saying a rabbi, but many people can be a rabbi, you get ordained. A Rebbe is really the big daddy of rabbis, so to speak.
Right.
Someone we used to love, we look forward to. I mean, some of the other movements used to make fun of Chabad because they used to say, "Who are you praying to, God or to your Rebbe?" Mm. Such was our love for the Rebbe. You know, big pictures in the home everywhere. And you know, it's about you wanting to make the Rebbe happy. When it's your birthday, you send a letter to the Rebbe requesting for a blessing. I flew to New York many times where the Rebbe was when he was alive. He died in 94. But many times as a kid, I used to travel to New York, especially for the high holidays, and just to be in the vicinity of the Rebbe, because such was the spirituality. Mm. and the invigoration he gave us all to continue our daily tradition. And in particular, for the Lubavitcher Rebbe, what an important component of the Chabad movement was to go and reach out to other fellow Jews, not non-Jews, because Judaism is not a proselytizing religion, but it was about finding Jews wherever they are in the world, in the most far-flung of places, and just make them or provide them the opportunity to undertake a mitzvah, a commandment, to do something that will bring them closer to God.
And refresh their connection.
That's right. And because ultimately the main aim within the Chabad movement is to see the Messiah, the coming of the Messiah. So the more mitzvot or the more commandments and positive things we do on a daily basis, the greater the chance of the Messiah coming and redeeming us all. Apparently.
Mm. Mm. And this connection that your family had was made particularly strong because you, when you were in Melbourne, lived right opposite the yeshiva centre. You were actually born in Israel and came to Australia at the age of 10, initially in Sydney for a while, and then into Melbourne. And 17 of you, that's, I mean, that's a quite an amazing thing in itself. But living right across the road must have made that connection so strong.
That's right. I mean, I did come to Australia at the age of 7, actually, not 10. But my mother also was the president of the women's, what's called the Sheikh Chabad, the Women of Chabad, which, you know, really, she was very active, arranged conferences. And my father was also someone where the Chabad community, if they wanted to send someone to for a Shabbat, a Sabbath meal, or international guests were coming in and they needed a place to stay, they often stayed at our house. So they were both very active in the community. Of course, as their children, we were very active in a number of ways. You're right, you know, our front yard and our backyard were the yeshiva center. We literally, it was a 1-2 minute walk into the center.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's where we were most of the time, most of the day, whether it's for playing sports in the morning before school or going to pray on the Sabbath or during the week or obviously school to study. We were there all the time.
And I mean, I don't want to make light of it, but at one point the council thought maybe your house was being used as a brothel because there were just so many bedrooms in it.
Well, when my parents requested the permit, in the beginning it took them a long time to authorise it because they were wondering why on earth you need 9 bedrooms and a couple
I'm sure
of
the inspector got a shock. Yeah. But one of the things you describe, and I find it really fascinating that this system exists in Australia alongside mainstream schooling, was the intensity of the kind of schooling that you had, not really because of academically what was going on, just because of the sheer hours you were there. As a more senior student, you were there from up until 9:30 at night and maybe even later.
Yes. We started off our mornings around 7 o'clock, going, dipping ourselves in the mikveh, in the ritual bath, male ritual bath. I used to go there every single morning. And we studied a blend of Hasidism, which is more mystical studies, and then as well as Talmud and the Bible. And then back in the evening, all the way to the evening. And it used to be a lot of celebrations infused in that. Again, Chabad, and this is the wonderful memories I have of Chabad. But there's a lot of singing, there's a lot of dancing. Often it involves alcohol, admittedly, at a very young age. I was drinking, offered drink from, you know, whether in the home or in the yeshiva center as well, and other people's homes from the age of 14. And, you know, let's not forget also, every Friday night we bless over the wine and every child is given a little bit of a sip.
Yes,
but there's obviously a big difference between that and having whiskey or vodka to celebrate a 14-year-old birthday. But that was very common. And kids were given that as well. But again, that was the part that I did enjoy. Well, not only the alcohol, also the singing and the...
And these wonderful nights of, you know, you describe one household in particular with lots of chicken and rice just to be able to feed the 20, 30 people who'd come through the door to celebrate together. What a wonderful...
There's a true community feeling. And even you know, when you get in such a group together and everyone's singing, then it was okay to listen to some biblical words because you're in that moment and it becomes spiritual. Of course, I feel very differently about that now, but back then it was something that I used to look forward to. A farbrengen. I mean, there's a word for it, a farbrengen, which is a get together, a religious get together where there's song, where there's discussions around religious things. So it was a lot of fun.
Yet another fantastic word from the Yiddish language. Now, you do write that actually. Your studies did sort of stop being about maths and English quite quickly and was really about absorbing religious material.
From the age of 12 years old, that's right. Mm. So my last, I remember middle of year 7 is when I finished my general studies. And I was very happy about that at the time.
Yeah, so that's a real inculcation. And has that held you back in your later life? Have you had to go back and cover material that you probably should have done in high school years?
There's no question that you find yourself limited in some ways having gone through that experience. Even people within the Chabad movement who perhaps would go on to finish year 10 or even in a few cases in Australia till VCE, year 12, you're still going to lack many things when you're talking to people, whether it's about TV culture, for example, because none of us watched TV as kids, or at least not in the home. We used to sneak out and watch a bit of footy or cricket or whatever we could get away with. So there are going to be gaps for me.
No novels, no mainstream music.
No, absolutely not. Not Jewish music. I mean, you know, I remember all, you know, the first not Jewish music I heard, Richard Marx.
Oh no!
Yeah, Oceans Apart. Yeah, yeah, Righty Waiting for You or something. Yeah,
well,
yeah, yeah.
You came off a low bass.
But you haven't heard some of the Jewish music I was listening to, so we can make comparisons later. But you know, it was the first for everything that you can kind of a milestone, and therefore you are obviously going to be lacking a lot in your education when you're conversing with someone who comes from mainstream Australian society. Mm. So there is that. But for me, it was even exacerbated by the fact that in terms of my general studies, I had no maths, no English, no science, none of those things. That all finished at the age of 12. And therefore, has it held me back? I mean, I had to do a lot of catch up. I went to Israel to serve in the army, and then I got back here when I was that in the year 2000? So I was about 24, 25. I started my VCE, my year 12 equivalent. And I did that over 2 years, 25 and 26, while I was working. And it was a challenge. I mean, doing my first essay at that age. And again, I had lived for the last 6 years in Israel, so speaking a foreign language, so my level of English was nowhere near the level where it should be. And I remember walking around and having conversations where I genuinely didn't understand many of the words, in some cases, what the people were telling me. And I remember at the end of each conversation, I'd sit down and write a list of the words that I didn't understand. At the end of the day, or every few days, I used to check up on the dictionary, write out exactly the meaning, and then eventually I used to improve.
Yeah, so catching up. But yep. Yeah. On Life Matters, we're talking with Manny Wax. He's written a book called Who Gave You Permission, about his experience inside the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community he grew up in, and also about the sexual abuse that he suffered inside that community. Manny, I just want to read a little moment from your book. You write that the rabbis and teachers who nurtured, taught and shaped me were not like teachers at a public school or even a private religious school. These men loomed as giants to my youthful, fragile mind. Fierce and friendly, they were figures of awe-inspiring authority, my moral and ethical prophets in a complex world. That's you're describing immense power there.
Yeah, it's, you know, that's what we were talking about earlier on, where we lived across the road from Yeshiva. We were there all the time, they were there all the time, and it wasn't just when you're seeing someone walking past them, it's a teacher. It's much more than that. It's someone that you have strong family connections in many ways. Mm. They would come to your house for a meal, or you would go to their house for a meal. You've got that social element, and you've got that demagogic aspect as well. Mm. So it's really people we looked up to, people you aspire to be, people who you can see the respect and that they receive based on their knowledge, based on their connection to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Obviously you don't see a lot of the hypocrisies that I've come to see over in more recent years. But those are just the wonderful things, and you look up to them and you aspire to be like them and want to be in their good books at all times as well.
And in this context is where this abuse occurred. Can you describe for us in whatever level of detail that you feel comfortable with the first person who abused you and what happened to you?
Yeah, I mean, the first time it ever happened was on a Jewish festival of Shavuot, and it's traditional to stay up all night for men and study the Torah. It's the festival where we received the Bible, and Moses received it, went up to Mount Sinai and received the Ten Commandments. So that's when we received the Bible, and we stay up all night to learn it and celebrate that particular experience. And I'd stayed up, this was around 88, something like that, 88. 87 possibly, and I went into synagogue and wanted to rest. It was about 1 o'clock at night. After studying for quite a while, I went upstairs to the ladies' section because the women were at home. It's more traditional for the men to stay up. I don't think any women stay up all night to study. And when I went up there, noticed someone was following me. As we've now come to know, abuse doesn't just happen where a stranger comes and just sexually abuses you. There's a whole grooming process. So this was someone, Velvel Serebransky, who used to read the Bible at synagogue where I used to go. And so he followed me upstairs, and after he gained my trust and to some degree, I don't know about admiration, but certainly someone that, you know, I used to enjoy hanging around with, because in the back of yeshiva, he used to give me access to driving his car in the backyard there at the age of about 11 and 12. So it was someone that was fun, but I realized something felt wrong, and I went to lie down on the bench to rest, and he came and kneeled beside me. And that's when, even before then, I knew something was up, and I just closed my eyes, pretended to be asleep, knowing full well that he realized that I wasn't asleep. And he started to touch me on the legs and on my clothes, and then started to molest me on my clothes, unbuckled my belt. And this is, again, in the synagogue, in the women's section, as an 11 or 12-year-old kid. And I remember freezing, pretending to be asleep and hoping that this will finish. But then all of a sudden he just said in my ear that it's inappropriate for a place like this. We should, as in for a synagogue, we should go outside. And for some reason I followed him. And we went into the bathroom, the women's bathroom. Again, no one was there. And that's when things escalated further, clothes off. And that was very traumatizing. And I remember waking up. I mean, I won't go into too much detail of what I remember was happening there, but I do remember kind of waking up. I almost must have blacked out to some degree, or for some of the time anyway, because I do remember getting up on the floor, and my pants and underpants were around my ankles, and there was silence, and I just got up, got dressed, and just walked home, or got out of there anyway, and I can't remember much after that. So, you know, the impact something like that would have by someone in a position of trust and authority, someone who's a very big name. His father was my teacher. His grandfather was my teacher. You know, someone who's very well, a family at least, that's well respected in the community, in the Chabad community in particular, doing it on one of the most significant days in the Jewish calendar inside a synagogue. Wouldn't have helped my response at the time towards religion and towards my community.
Yeah, and I think that dissociation that you describe, and that feeling of just complying because that will make it stop, is something that people describe so much, and that we've heard it so many times. It's a very common response. It did go on. He really sort of continued to pester you, abuse you for a couple of months or so. One of the things I found really heartbreaking was that you told a friend of yours at school.
Yeah.
Now, he's gone on to be, you know, like a real stalwart for you, but he kind of betrayed this confidence.
He did betray the confidence back during those days. And to be honest, while I was suffering, I mean, that exacerbated my suffering by a significant margin, because, you know, you're being sexually abused on the, you know, in private, and then you go to school and you're being constantly bullied and called gay, pufta, all these derogatory terms for something.
Because suddenly everyone seemed to know what it was going on.
Yes.
And instead of, as you'd turn to him, you know, for, I don't know, what, anything, any kind of solace, in fact, the opposite had happened.
Yeah, I guess a lot of it was a test to see if I can share it with someone and what would happen. And so by the time the second perpetrator came along, David Tsipras, I learned to be very careful with what I say and to whom. And I therefore don't recall sharing that with anyone. But again, everyone seemed to know about that. And I should just, I think, correct you if I understood correctly, because my classmate who I did share it with, you know, years later, just a few years ago when the police were investigating, I did contact him. It took him 18 months to agree to actually give a statement, which was very disappointing because all those years later, when we were 18, he apologized for what he did, and I accepted it. I was, you know, we were still friends, and it was what kids do, and as a kid, I'm sure I hurt many other children as well. So it's not acceptable, but I understand it, especially at an older age, you can forgive. But what I could not, I caused me to rethink that forgiveness is really when I approached him to go to the police about it, to give a police report, whatever he remembered. He was reluctant, and it took him 18 months approximately to actually do that.
And in cases such as this, it's difficult because you are relying on, on only, you know, witness. There's barely very hard to produce evidence in these cases. You mentioned that there was a second abuser, and he was a karate instructor and also a security guard at the Yeshiva Center. After this, you kind of went off the rails, and you actually got sort of kicked out.
Yes, I mean, I got kicked out of everywhere, got kicked out of school, got kicked out of Yeshiva Gadol, of the two high schools or higher learning of religious studies. I got kicked out of home. My parents, they didn't know how to react to, I was the oldest boy of 17 children. Mm. I mean, at the time, they wouldn't have been 17 yet. But they'd never experienced a rebellious child. And
you were acting out in all kinds of ways.
Yeah, I mean, look, really at the time it was mostly rebellion against religion. So switching the lights on and off on the Sabbath and not wearing a kippah or a yarmulke on my head and not washing your hands a few times. So it wasn't on the – we're not talking about extreme stuff. We're talking about, you know, right. By compared to in a secular Australia, you know, it wasn't drugs. It wasn't – there was alcohol. Alcohol was a bit of an issue back then. But I was able to conceal some of that because, again, you live in a family with so many children. Every time I vomited, I used to put it into the washing and hide it. My mother never noticed it. And, you know, so a lot of the times they noticed things only because someone told them. And often it would be a sibling of mine because my siblings were everywhere. So if I got kicked out of class, I was standing outside of class, I knew I'd get home. And then one of my siblings would have told my parents. And then the belt would have come. So, you know, so I was acting out in that way, rebelling. And then my parents trying to figure out how to respond. And they would have gotten some advice from either from teachers or from the rabbis, as often it's important to remember that within this context, ultra-Orthodoxy, parents, anyone, you go, you have a rabbi and you go to them for advice and guidance.
So kind of fast forwarding, you went back to Israel for a while. You came back as a young man back into the family, and it was when you were here, you actually heard something on the radio that sparked your next action. What was that?
Yeah, I mean, I happened to be sitting in my parents' home and listening to the radio, and I heard about Operation Paradox, that if you have any information about child sexual abuse, come forward. And the bizarre thing is that until that point, I had never even considered going to the police. And that just, that mattered. It was so natural for me. I remember just walking downstairs and going to my dad's office and saying, I just heard this on the radio. I need to tell you that this is what happened to me. Can you please call the police? And of course, you know, he was just shocked and asked a few questions, but he definitely responded in a way that was very comfortable in terms of, you know, whether the right process needs to happen, and contacted the police. And before I knew it, I was being interviewed and giving a statement.
Mm. He was very supportive, as was your mother. Yeah. What happened to the family? I mean, your parents now live in Israel. They don't live in Australia like you. You live in France, I think the Loire Valley, and they've kind of moved on because of the fallout of this.
Correct. Well, we actually, I moved to the Loire Valley for the first 10 months, and now we're actually moved to Israel.
Oh, you're in Israel
so
now too.
We're in Israel, yes, okay. For a number of reasons. It turned our lives upside down, and it's. I still walk around feeling like I don't have a home. I feel exiled. Since we left Australia in January 2015, so it's been over a year and a half ago, every time I've come back, and I've been back to Australia about five times, every time I've come back here, it hasn't felt like home. But I must say, this time has been a bit different. I'm not sure why. There are probably a number of reasons, perhaps the book and that kind of closure and finality and coming around. But I did feel like I could at some stage return here with my family to live. It's not quite so simple because the toll it has taken on my family, my wife and children, children, which I don't really discuss in the book, and that is to keep them, to protect their privacy. This is my story, and of course they're an important part of my story, but I do respect my wife's wishes to remain out of the public eye. But you know, I immensely dislike living in Israel. I don't feel like it's home for me. It's probably based around the fact that there are cultural differences, but there is also, I think, a lot of it comes down to the fact that the circumstances in which we were forced to go there. It wasn't as if it was a choice to say we want to go to
Israel. And you're an Australian.
Israel.
You're an Australian.
Exactly
as well.
Right.
Just finally, when you look back, what's the message that you want to tell the world about what happened and what you see?
I guess one of the reasons for me to share my story through this book, I know everyone has heard different aspects of my story, and when they and often I hear, "Wow, you're so strong! You're a great voice for all of us," and everything like that, and it's wonderful, and it does empower me, and it gives me the encouragement to continue, especially when I hear so much of the successes and the impact, the positive impact it's having, but. People really don't understand the impact it has, even on someone like me, as in, you know, who's seen as a relative success story.
And reflecting on your community?
Absolutely. We need to know, we need to acknowledge that these types of things happen in all segments of society. We need to have a better understanding of the impact it has on us, so that once we understand what's happened in the past in terms of the impact, in terms of the abuse, in terms of the community response, once we have a better understanding of that, only then can we move forward in a way that will ensure the prevention and the safety of our children into the future.
And how do you feel about the Chabad community that you grew up in?
Look, I'm seeing the progress over the years, and I'm very pleased. I was at the Yeshiva Center about a week ago, giving a session, presenting to the high-level management team at the center. So there is this engagement. I'm very proud of my association with them. I'm proud to see the work that we've done. Many of us have been involved over the last few years, and the progress that it has led to. So many positives. I have no doubt that children today are much safer than they ever were in this context, and probably even beyond this context. So I think for me, there's a lot of satisfaction in that. But having said that, I also see there's a long way to go. There are still problems in the culture, and that is something that I'm working to continue to address.
Manny Wax, thank you for telling us your story, and welcome home.
Thank you. Thank you, Cassie.
Manny Wax's book is called Who Gave You Permission? The Memoir of a Child Sexual Abuse Survivor Who Fought Back, and we'll put the details of where you might be able to track it down on the Life Matters program page.